Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of NymFed Alumni. I'm Sam. I'm here with Biz and Alexi. Today, we're going to be talking about something that I think we're going to coin. It's definitely not something we invented, but I think that we are going to add this aesthetic into the large and ever-growing library of odd early 2000s aesthetics that will go on Aesthetic Wiki or like Kari Institute or something like that. We just want to formally submit this to the board for review, but I think we're calling it the loner girl aesthetic, which I think a lot of people would recognize. Everybody knew a girl like this in middle school and high school if you went to middle school and high school during the 2000s or 2010s. And it's really underscored by teen literature, certain stylistic elements like knitwear, fingerless gloves, sneaker flats, layered clothing, like very like Fruits magazine type of layering, several layers of tight socks, leg warmers. And I think we're going to kind of just discuss and deconstruct like what this archetype of girl is, because she, as the name suggests, is quite lonely. Like she doesn't really belong to any larger subculture, but contains and combines and remixes a lot of elements of various subcultures without ever fully committing to anyone. But yeah, what do you guys like? How would you guys introduce this to people in a way that they could kind of visualize? Because if this is very visual heavy, you guys should definitely go look at the Pinterest to see what we're talking about. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I love the Pinterest for this episode. Yeah, it's very interesting to me because I feel like this is a relic of the time before, maybe not like choice feminism, but there was an element of this that was like very proudly not like other girls. And as the name suggests, kind of introverted or just like aberrant from society. And it's very eclectic, but in a way that is not aspiring to something cool. I was actually so surprised that there are so many like runway examples of this because I just associate it so much with like true individualism and like Barnes and Noble ass girls. But yeah, it's cool to know that it really did trickle down from high fashion.
Yeah, that's what's really interesting about it is the more I looked at inspirational images for this episode, the more I realized that this very much was the aesthetic of like the early, very influential fashion bloggers of the early 2000s. One of them that definitely had a lot of looks documented that were this aesthetic was Tavi Gevinson in her preteen blog, The Style Rookie, before Rookie Magazine. She definitely had that sort of kind of quirky, frumpy, funky layering vibe that I think was too Junya Watanabe to fully be loner girl, but she had those elements, right? Like, especially with the knitwear beanies with, it's like crochet beanies with like little flowers on them, you know, canvas messenger bags. I think like a lot of the clothing items of this aesthetic probably stink really bad because I remember like wearing some stuff like this when I was in middle school. Like sneaker flats or flats in general. Like, I don't know why flats of this time really started to stink. Like a bowling alley, like canvas messenger bags. I remember having one and bringing it home from school and it just like stinking like bowling alley for some reason. The beanies too, like the crochet beanies, the fingerless gloves. I just think that because this is such a schoolyard aesthetic that throughout the day in middle school or high school or even elementary school, you're just kind of getting down and dirty and coming home a little ripe.
It's also just very not precious. Like you have a canvas messenger bag that you're probably like tossing on the ground and like it's got like an open Sharpie inside of it. Like it's bleeding everywhere.
When we talk about like, I guess the YA aspect of this young adult fiction, we talked about like Bridge Terabithia a lot. And I feel like Leslie, who is the female loner girl and protagonist in Bridge Terabithia, is a really good example of that because she's really outgoing and imaginative, like to the point where her internal world becomes external. And it's like, so yeah, like she cannot be contained at the seams. Her rich inner world must spill out.
Yeah, I think that's what's really interesting to me because I think a lot of it can go from manic pixie dream girl to kind of trauma core. That's kind of the spectrum of where a lot of these girls exist, or at least in literature exist, maybe in real life. But a lot of the books that like I associate with this type of girl are kind of like early proto trauma core books that you would find at the school library or were assigned to read in middle school by like the young teacher who like wanted to help out like the at-risk kids or something, like Speak, you know, which a lot of people know the movie Speak with Kristen Stewart. Crank. I don't know if anybody remembers those Ellen Hardwick books, like
Teachers
Crank.
Were always telling me to read those. I don't know why the fuck. Like,
right?
That was like those a little major. Life level trauma.
Yeah.
Dude, yeah. Like, I think it's just like teachers in at this time, they were probably receiving sensitivity training that's like differs very distinctly from what they are now. Like, I think that maybe the training that they're receiving is to like look out for signs of like really severe things like meth addiction or like teen pregnancy, sex abuse, like that type of thing.
Yeah. It's so crazy because I feel like now the canon is like a lot more about mental health and like mental disorders, which are definitely an element of these. But I feel like, as we mentioned before we started recording, like in a lot of these books, they're just like events that happen to this character, like the lonely girl in question. And she's just like being eaten away at by the world and mm-hmm. just like forced to be in a position of like only responding to everything, but is somehow like quirky and brave despite it all.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it makes me think that there are like social phenomena that have maybe just gone extinct. Like I feel like being a runaway was a big thing at this time. Teen pregnancy was a big thing at this time. Maybe we beat those and like now it's all become very like introspective and like everyone is trapped in their own twisted mind instead of, you know, running away from home. This was also the time that like Precious came out, which that was like an OG like teen trauma core.
Yeah,
we had like a lot of like the kind of prestige literature and cinema focused around like somebody that went
abuse,
to like one
yeah
abuse or somebody that like experienced like one core traumatic event, which of course
yeah, that's revealed at the end.
It's almost like a simplistic approach to trauma because like in the movie Speak, right, Kristen Stewart, or you know, the main character, I've only seen the movie, I haven't read the book, so, but you know, she's doesn't speak for an entire year and it's like this huge mystery as to why, and everyone kind of suspects that there's like trauma behind this like completely silent girl's silence. And then at the end of the movie, it's like revealed that she was raped at a party by like some sort of fratty individual. And so it's like she finally is able to speak and like kind of identify her abuser and begin her healing journey. But I feel like that is like a really simplistic view of the way that things like that happen. Like, not that I'm an expert on this by any means, but it does feel like the complexity of like the healing process is like really lost in some of these narratives because they are almost impossible to capture in like a narrative, you know. But yeah, like I remember, yeah, this being such a thing, like being pushed to read a bunch of books that had content in it that like I wasn't even exposed to at the age that I was reading them at, right? Like Go Ask Alice, The Glass Castle, A Child Called It, like a bunch of books about like really serious abuse. And I was given these when I was like in sixth grade, fresh out of elementary school, you know. Crank was something that girls read at that point, and which is like literally about like drug addiction. And I didn't even know what Crank was when
I
was
so
in sixth
weird,
grade.
I feel
you know
like
what I mean?
It's instead of like the reading level going up in school being like, you know, more complex prose, they're like, as you're getting older, you just have to deal with like extremely mature themes instead of like more complicated writing formally.
Yeah. Also, the perks of being a wallflower was like the boy version of this, but obviously young girls.
Yeah, he also
loved
gets
reading
sexually
that.
Abused. I mean, that was the whole thing in 13 Reasons Why as well. Like, I think this is almost kind of proto true crime because they always had like a kind of procedural mystery aspect to it where like the main character obviously has something wrong with them. Like the whole 13 Reasons Why mystery was like, why did she kill herself? It's because she got sexually assaulted.
Yeah. I think part of this is just like actually truly generational though, because I think when they say like, when I was a kid, we didn't talk about these things. Mm-hmm. It's true.
Yeah.
And so I think the people that were writing these books who were basically Gen Xers and boomers were writing them from, like, for example, the author of Bridge to Terabithia, the plot line for Leslie, who's like kind of a rejected, isolated, but charismatic and outgoing and really creative young girl, was kind of inspired by her own feelings of alienation as a child. But she's in like her 70s now. But I think overall it's interesting to look back on this connection because a lot of the visual language of this, which I think really was initially oriented towards like fashion and design. We'll talk about like different designers and I guess design movements that are key here, was really co-opted by, I guess, PSA culture, which those books kind of were like PSAs.
Yeah.
And I also saw in some previous research that this aesthetic called corporate grunge, which was coined by the Consumer Aesthetics Research Institute, which is like a design style from the 90s and derived from the Pacific Northwest grunge music scene, and was an accumulation of work by independent creative designers behind magazines like the music mag Ray Gun. But it's known for having this kind of like really earthy, rusty color palette, retro type faces, kind of felt really edgy. And it's most famous for being used in the famous or infamous You Wouldn't Steal a Car anti-piracy PSA that ran from 2004 to 2007. But the point of this is that that ad is like identical to the covers for the Crank series.
Yeah.
So yeah, they were really using this visual language to activate not a moral panic, but concern.
Yeah, I think it was to signal. Yeah, it signaled like
urgency,
crime, and well, yeah,
deviancy. I think
deviancy definitely. It signaled delinquency.
Delinquency.
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's just the distressed look of the time, and also kind of like the emphasis on physical media. Like all of the typefaces seem like they're trying to replicate like an inky kind of graffiti typewriter letterpress smudgy like distressed thing. The PSA thing is real though, because I was also thinking about the social, I guess, like responsibility that drove a lot of this stuff, and I do think that you're right that it's like a generational thing. But it also was like, yeah, this was the time that like bullying was like a huge deal.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like it was the time of like Facebook posts that were like, that boy you called gay in the hallway, he like is gonna kill himself tomorrow. So yeah, the invention of like bullying and like the anti-bullying charge at the time, I feel like really inspired people to navigate society differently or like yeah. Young people to like just be less judgmental. Or like, I think everyone was just like always like having to assume the worst. Like I remember at the time, if I didn't like anyone, or if like I had a conflict with someone, my mom was like, well, what if they're getting abused at home? And I was like, okay, why would that be the case?
You know what I mean? You never know what's going on behind closed doors type thing.
Yeah, everyone just became like really, really careful about it.
Well, I mean, something I think this is so random because I was even talking to my dad about this subject today, weirdly, because listeners may not know this. My dad's like in college right now. This is kind of a long story, but he's 70 and he's going to like university classes and stuff. It was like his retirement dream to go back to school. So he was describing kind of the differences that he felt from the students today to what students were like back in his day. And he was very struck by how kind and positive a lot of the students were in class. Whenever somebody presents or there's some sort of critique, everybody is always searching for like the nicest thing to say about it before, you know, they preface something kind before giving like an actual critique, or don't give a critique at all. Like you're very, very kind and nice to your classmates. And he said back in his day, like people were a lot more cutting and like straightforward. I think Gen Z in general is like very, very nice in person and like very, and I think they reserve their bullying for like the TikTok comment section, which I feel like maybe isn't even as brutal as it can be. I don't think it's as brutal as like the way like people kind of spoke to each other in the past. I don't really know, but it's interesting that this whole vibe that we have sort of a cultural memory of is derived from high fashion, because I think like something that we often forget as like fashion fans, wouldn't really say we're in the fashion world, but like fashion universe adjacent people, that like there used to really be this sort of like element of the fashion world that was about, deeply about being an outcast and being a well-decorated kind of freak and weirdo. Like there's a sort of cozy kind of weirdo thing that was going on in the early 2000s that I think the fashion bloggers really embodied. I also think Marc Jacobs as like a person and Alexander McQueen as a person both had this like inherent vibe pre-weight loss. You know, I think they both had like struggles with like being bullied by the media for being, you know, husky individuals. But they were like, they had this vibe where they were very timid and frumpy and like, you know, very kind of shy. And they probably were bullied in school for being gay or something. And it did feel like they're in their early careers. They had this sort of kind of fragility to them that I felt was really beautiful and like vulnerable and gorgeous. And you can kind of see that they were trembling to unleash this rich inner world that they had probably developed as a defense mechanism for like past struggles, you know, feeling like a part of a larger group, you know? But I do think like that's where that loner girl thing came from within the fashion world, is like designers that maybe had never found like an outlet to be accepted within society and were finally kind of able to unleash this sort of fantasy onto the runway.
Yeah, that's true. It feels like quite subcultural, but in such an individualistic way that it's not like punk or like a movement that's based on collectivism or like trying to find your subculture of people. Like, it really is just so lonely and like weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, the outcasting is real. It's also like in talking about like the social vibe of it, I think maybe there was more of an emphasis on like projecting your troubled nature back in the day, if you know what I mean. Like, I think stuff like emo probably like set the stage for like, you know, if you have this like inner turmoil or like rich inner world, the responsibility is on you to show that to others through your styling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, connecting the external inner world and then also the Marc Jacobs point. So his fall 2005 ready to wear collection was partially inspired by Violet from The Incredibles, who is obviously the sullen teenage girl. Like, she's the loner girl of The Incredibles family. And I really liked finding that out, because also this collection is like, I was looking through his collections in the early 2000s, because whilst this, we can see this from like early 2000s into very early 2010s, I had a feeling that obviously he was cooking something up in like the early 2000s with this. And this collection in particular has a lot of felt hats, a lot of purple baby doll dresses, collared dresses, velvets, and another key theme in it is the use of these rosettes, and they're on everything from the bust of a dress to a tweed muffler. And then also there's a lot of like tattered collars and cardigans and knit caps that are veiled with lace. And I kind of feel like this collection is like the, not the originator of everything, but this is where we can really see what was being distilled by Marc and then basically made its way over the ensuing decade into like Barnes and Noble merchandise.
I think also what is a great pipeline for that too is that I feel like Marc Jacobs, of course, is like a huge pioneer in terms of making runway brands available in department stores in affordable ways with all of his offshoot brands like Marc by Marc Jacobs, Jacobs by Marc Jacobs, and those things were really affordable in comparison to some of his other stuff. I don't really remember how affordable they were. I just remember as a teenager buying a Marc Jacobs wallet and with my own money, and I was somehow able to afford it. And like, it couldn't have been that expensive if I bought it, you know, but like, I do think like that that's where kind of like the department store element of like some of this, the high fat. And then I also, yeah, like I think it's easy to, I don't know where I was going with that. Sorry.
Well, yeah. His designs as well, when I was reading about this era of his career and his brand on Vogue Runway, they mentioned that his work as a designer was so influential in terms of proliferating into mall fashion. Mm-hmm. So it's like, not only did he have his own kind of diffusion lines that we can recall like Marc by Marc Jacobs, but also just for whatever reason, his designs and his taste were very accessible to the mainstream once they were reinterpreted through lower tier brands.
Yeah, Rocket Dog, Mud.
Yeah, I feel like the mall brand that I associate with it the most is like Francesca's. I feel like they had a lot of exposed wood and quirky accessories and like tattered kind of knit garments.
Yeah, early Francesca's was a completely different vibe. I would do anything to go back to Francesca's in 2006 or something. If it was around then, I don't know, but probably was. Yeah, there's just like a lot of like early runway influence. Like I wasn't realizing how like Anna Sui was very much this vibe in the early 2000s, if not like the year 2000 is, I feel like whenever it started getting introduced in the runway. Betsy Johnson had some amazing collections, fall 1999, where the sort of like layered frumpy loner girl started emerging. And I also think like a loner girl leader stylistically was Keira Knightley when she was dating Jamie Kennedy, which obviously is like a big mood boarded era of Keira Knightley's. And I think a lot of like girls have been mood boarding it, but not really. It's interesting because I feel like a lot of these elements are being mood boarded by modern fashion girls, but the frumpy element is being left behind. And I think that's like a huge mistake. Like, I think it's getting a little too sexified and it's, you know, I don't think it's like female gazy or almost like Manic Pixie Dream Girl gazy enough. Like, I kind of want it to be more frumpy.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think that's like the failure of the Office Siren revival. Yes. And I forgot who I like even saw posting about this, but I feel like I've been seeing discourse that's like it's getting like so fetishy and so like porn category. And that ultimately takes kind of all the fun out of it. Also, like being a nerd or being like a geek or whatever was such a real identity at this time. I don't think that's a thing anymore.
Well, we could introduce it into our cafeteria that we've been orientating for the past few episodes.
I know, this is like a part of the cafeteria trilogy.
It's like these girls, here. That's what I really feel like, why I called it loner girls, because like these girls had so many elements of like hipsterism, of kind of like the Evanescence, Renaissance, fairy tale core vibe, of kind of like the Blythe Dolls storybook aesthetic. And it had all of these different elements of like kind of communities and aesthetic groupings, but it was never fully committing to anyone. And I think that's like what made her so lonely. It's like she was definitely like weird and quirky and dressed funny, but was never cool enough to like sit with some of the weirdos that like banded together. So she would go to the library and eat lunch in the library and read all of the books that we listed earlier, you know?
Yeah.
And like, that's where like the rich inner world comes in. I feel like it comes from like an alienation thing where you're kind of forced to create your own Terabithia in your mind where you can exist perfectly, you know?
Also, I feel like in the storytelling around these girls, they're so resilient. Like another young adult classic we'll be talking about today is Looking for Alaska by John Green. Mm-hmm. So whether it's like Leslie and Bridge Terabithia or Alaska, there's like inherent charisma that they have, so they don't care that everyone's like, you're a loser, boo, you're a loser, which I think is like actually really hard to do in real life. Yeah. But possible for some if you have a rich enough inner world, maybe.
Yeah, from my personal experience of witnessing girls like this, and I had friends that were somewhat like this, again, like never fully connected with them because I feel like they never fully let anybody in or something. Mm-hmm. They had this very, they had such a weird vibe where they had a mystique to them that I think people were not mature enough to understand. I don't know. I feel like I'm romanticizing this too much in my head, but.
Well, they were certainly like precocious, and that's something that adults tend to tolerate much more than other children. Like, for example, like Tavi Gevinson was a darling of the adult media world.
Also, another person that I have never heard of this person until I got on Pinterest, but this girl, Emily Martin of the Black Apple blog, fashion blog, has some of the greatest fits I've seen in a really long time. And this other kind of Russian, I think, or Eastern European photographer named Zoetika Ebb, which both are pinned frequently on the board. I mean, just some of the greatest like fashion looks I've seen in a really long time. And I'm really wondering why this isn't a thing with everybody that's kind of like adopting these newer fashion movements, like Office Chic or maybe even like Fruits Magazine Girls. I just think like they have all of the pieces of this in their closet, but they're just like not putting it together or remixing it in the way that I want them to.
Yeah. I think the point about it being still somewhat like too desexualized seems accurate. I think we'll probably talk a lot about Miuccia Prada today as a leader of geek chic, and also Miu Miu being the leader of the office worker, office siren look, and then the Miu Miu girl. But yeah, the loner girl, her frump bypassed adulthood, I think, into like textures, materials, and pairings that we really associate more with grandma and sometimes babies, but not babies in like a kid core way. It's like the crochet, for example. I don't know. It's
that's brilliant.
I'm like, wow, this is anti-fashion. But then it was so cute.
That is so true.
It really is. I do love the DIY, like crochet and macrame and just like all of the levels of interest when it comes to texture and prints. Like the florals of this time were really hitting. And I feel like there was also a lot of like digital printing, like clothes that tried to mimic Baroque patterns or lace, or like a lot of knitted stripes and plaids. It makes sense that Marc Jacobs was like on this vibe because it is really reminiscent of like his early grunge stuff, but girlified in a way that is really appealing.
Yeah. And also I think his relationship to Sofia Coppola, I was reflecting on it a bit, and she's obviously so successful, but in my head, she's like a popular loner, even though she's not. But like the bookishness that she has and like her like library of references and ideas, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's what's interesting is they had, because I always thought Marc Jacobs or Sofia Coppola was Marc Jacobs's muse proper, but it almost feels like they weren't really, they didn't really have a muse master relationship. It was almost like they both had a mutual muse of the loner girl and were able to kind of both be masters of this fantasy world. But her loner girl fantasy was a lot more pastel, coquette-y, like teen dream gone awry. And Marc Jacobs was like the fall version. I don't know, like kind of the fall paletted Bridge to Terabithia version of the loner girl of Sofia Coppola's dreams.
I feel like that speaks to their identities though, because like I said, Sofia was born into Hollywood royalty. She's so beautiful. And then Mark was like, as we mentioned, he was a little frumpy and dumpy at the beginning of his career. So they're, putting their own lens on it.
They met in the middle,
It's cool to make that comparison, Sam.
Yeah, they had their own approaches to it. It was very like color centric. And it's funny that Alexander McQueen didn't really have like a phase like this, but I think he was truly in some dark headspaces, as we all know. But I feel like that's the thing is I was just really contemplating since the last episode where we had that conversation about Azealia Banks and Aisha Erotica and kind of how much we overvalue social intelligence in our contemporary moment, where we have forced people like Marc Jacobs to become social butterflies and really kind of like slay on a socialite front and be kind of like a personality. And, you know, not to say anything about like Heaven by Marc Jacobs, but like I much prefer early Marc Jacobs's work whenever he was kind of fighting against like outcast allegations or, and I don't actually know enough about his personal biography to say that he actually was an outcast, but I do know from certain interviews he has this vibe, you know, when he retells stories of starting out in the industry and being creative director of Louis Vuitton and kind of feeling very nervous to speak to people and being really surprised whenever people gave him the time of day and like actually engaged with his work. And I think, I don't know, I appreciate that sort of bookishness and nervousness to share something so intimate and part of you, you know? Like, I feel like if we overvalue the social element, like people will be too shy to share like the actually beautiful things about them because it's like too vulnerable of an artistic object to show to the world.
Yeah. On a psychological level, I feel like that has to be part of the reason behind certain elements of this style. Like I feel like all of it is so layered, but not in like a necessarily maximalistic way. Like it just really screams like vulnerability and coziness and like sweater paws and being like a fragile animal.
Yeah, you're like who's bubble like wrapped in crochet. Like
these. Yeah, it's really like fragility core. And to think of him like being at this state where he's like anxious about his creative expression and he's just like layering all of this stuff on models and like being really productive and I don't know, it's very cute. Yeah.
I just wanted to talk briefly so that we have our sources cited about the very, very famous Prada Spring Summer 1996 collection, just to, I guess, fully flesh out the geek chic history here. But I'm sure most of our listeners have probably seen images from this collection. They're often analyzed as like a turning point in fashion. It was Miuccia's, I guess, most controversial collection. But in terms of what it contributed to the loner girl, it had like out of style patterns from the 1950s. The models were wearing Mary Janes. There was a lot of like drab purple and avocado green and muddy dirt browns that are really signature to, like, when you think of this collection, you think of the kind of that, I think someone called it, it was Alexander Fury called it Miuccia sludge, the color.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah, and it was called, like, the title of the collection was Banal Eccentricity. So it was like literally and figuratively looking at, I guess, stuff that was considered really unfashionable. And then obviously putting in the context of the runway. It's kind of like the adult version of how the loner girl dresses in some ways. But what I liked about this was like, yeah, we can see a lot of distant influence, like how much purple's in the collection, the hand-drawn patterns that are used, the chunky shoes, the avocado green and dirt brown. But one thing I wanted to talk about is like, so avocado green and dirt brown were not considered fashionable at this period. And they hadn't been fashionable since like the 70s when brown was considered to be a very acceptable and fashionable color to dress and decorate your house with. But I just wanted to connect that to the point that there's like, always feels like there's something a little bit crunchy about loner girls like this. Not in a kind of like hiking way, because they'd definitely be making imaginary worlds in like a mud puddle instead. But I don't know. I just always think of like Annie's organic mac and cheese when I think about these types of girls.
No, yeah. Yeah,
it does give like that first yes. wave of health food store and like muesli. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, that's what I feel like the element comes from. Like urban woodland activities, like urban exploring in the woods, not necessarily in nature, but kind of like in the concrete culverts beneath like a bridge. And it's just like kind of nasty, but like that's where your imagination thrives and you can imagine a sort of fairy tale universe and imagination thrives and you can imagine a sort of fairy tale universe. And like 13 Reasons Why, Speak, Bridge to Terabithia, there's a similar like urban kind of dirty woods that they all kind of like to share and have imaginative experiences. Yeah.
So essentially there is this like Japanese fashion subgenre called morike that is, it translates to like forest style or forest type, and it's like kind of Japanese cottagecore, but it originated in 2006, so it has a lot of those like classic early 2000s elements. And I feel like it's like a lot less literal than the American or like Western interpretation of cottagecore, which is a lot more like Renaissance-y. It just has like this type of layering and like complication that I think seems really influential to this style. So it's worth checking out. But just in relation to like nature and the crunchiness of it all, something to consider.
Yeah, I actually was thinking about what the current interpretations of this are. And one of my favorite micro trends from TikTok is grunge fairycore. I think it has the cutest name ever. I'm obsessed with it. And I've done so much like work around grunge fairycore. But that, I mean, they're probably different, but the forest element is certainly shared. And I feel like in some ways that's like a tie-in to the loner girl.
Yeah. But... Well, I think grunge fairy core is like the Gen Z version of this, and like millennial and Gen X was loner girl, but like,
yeah,
the spirit lives on in grunge fairy core for sure.
But that's such a good point, because grunge fairy core is still so much more, it's not sexualized, but there's like some corsets sometimes, there's like tattered clothing, short skirts, fairy wings. It has kind of lost, I think, sometimes that element we're talking about that feels like a soft skin for your animal body or whatever you were saying, Alexi.
Yeah, like you're wrapped up in a sleeping bag. Yeah, the grunge fairycore thing is like weird because I feel like it's not really real. Like you don't really see it. It's so like obviously like let me dress up and take photos in the forest.
Yeah,
guys, why do I see grunge fairycore girls around? But it's like at that farmer's market. Like I think it's like
I see girls like wearing like long skirts and like that patchwork hobo bag that's like really ugly.
Yeah,
I guess it just brown exists in different
just became
degrees.
Such a big color in the past few years.
Yeah, and like mossy green too. I feel like that is like Gen Z's favorite color.
And distressing.
But we need to bring back the mucha sludge. That's my new favorite term. Oh, I didn't know about the word mucha sludge. I had never heard
you
it.
Could
so now
you could either be, this is actually a good would you rather. I'm keeping it. I'm not telling you guys now.
Okay.
It's really just all giving like primordial fashion soup. Also, Vika was recently posting about like the history of prints at Prada. And I wish that I could find it, but it was like all on her story. But she was talking about Vika? This like one. Yeah, Vika from.
From our online. Podcast and our friend.
Our friend Vika, who's like a Prada historian. Yeah. She was posting about this one specific like geometric pattern that was at Prada that was from the era that you were talking about, Biz, that was influenced by the 70s and in these kind of busted colors. But it was this pattern that was like geometric, kind of like squovels with hollow insides. Mm-hmm. I don't even know how to describe it, but it was like a big point with the fashion press because everyone was obsessed with how ugly it was, and they were like, what the fuck's this print? And I think it was brought back by Raf Simons in like 2021, but that print definitely gives like nerd and freak. Like when I saw it, I was like, I definitely saw like dupes of this on the mass market and would have never thought that it came from
a Prada. Nerd and a freak.
Yeah, it was autumn 1996. You can see it in my collection.
Same year.
Different
season. Different.
Yeah.
Damn. She was really up to something that year.
And it's crazy how long. Yeah. It. One of the few Nepo babies who have really outshined their legacy, I feel like. But I don't know if I should say that honestly, but I feel like she's.
I feel like Prada genuinely wasn't like it's not even like she like took over the brand. I think she like really just started a new thing. Like, even though she's Nepo, there wasn't really that much for her to work with before.
Yeah.
Like it was kind of more of a classic like Italian fashion house that was making.
Yeah.
Like, in the same way that Gucci made like luggage.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, that's the same. That's Marc Jacobs thing too, where it's like Marc Jacobs. I think he did the first ever like clothing collection for Louis Vuitton. Like Louis Vuitton didn't have clothes until Marc Jacobs came in. So it's like kind of people who co-opted luxury accessory brands and made clothing out of them, you know?
Yeah. Are
really the pioneers of Loner Girl.
Also like Mucha obviously references herself as an archetype of woman a lot in her designs and her own kind of identity as like a very intelligent woman, and she used to be like a socialist activist in 1970s Italy. So yeah, I think it's interesting to contrast all these different lenses of interpreting what it means to be like a geeky girl. Like we can see it through like Marc Jacobs, through maybe not like geeky or loner girl, through Sofia Coppola, and then through Mucha Prada as well.
There, it's such a generation of like precocious loner girl children that had something to prove. I don't know.
Yeah. Also, just like we can also situate this somewhat within, I mean, I guess we've already talked about the feminism corresponding, but also girl power was a really big thing at this time, but not always in this super kind of like saturine Spice Girls way. Like, speaking of the universe of Marc Jacobs, there was also X-Girl, which was like really closely adjacent to their social circle. And Sofia Coppola, I think, modeled for it, Kim Gordon, etc. And yeah, there was just like an orientation on like being a girl, essentially.
Yeah, the feminism of this time is something that I definitely want to talk about. Maybe that can be our segue into the John Green.
Yes. Like, yeah, I'm really excited to talk about
universe.
That.
Yeah. John Green was like a huge deal. I feel like he needs no introduction. He was like a YA fiction author who wrote books such as Looking for Alaska, The Fault in Our Stars, Paper Towns, An Abundance of Catherines. And his signature was writing these kind of like teenage manic pixie dream girls who are like whirlwinds of chaos and quirkiness. But I don't know, he was kind of like self-aware about this, at least I like to think. He got like kind of soft canceled on Tumblr. He went from being this like universally beloved fandom dad type to being posted about on your fave is problematic, and we'll link the post. The crime on top of this list is that he objectified nerdy women, and there are like a few comments where there are like pull quotes from interviews or things that he's written where he's kind of like slut-shaming, but in a way that's like so distinctly 2000s. Like, I feel like in the 2000s, think like Pink Song, Stupid Girl, like it was just acceptable at that time to be like, anorexic bitches with fake boobs are stupid, you know? And so he was criticized for that. He was criticized for using the word slut. And this was kind of like when people were waking up into the like choice feminism matrix and being like, actually, it's not okay for men to say stuff like that about women. Also floating around Tumblr were slightly libelous posts that were like, isn't it kind of suspicious that all he writes about is teenage girls? And that kind of spiraled out into like people implying that he was a pedo, which I don't think he is. So this is kind of like the discussion point that I want to talk about is like, he became a victim of the manic pixie dream girl discourse as like its biggest perpetrator. Do we actually think that the manic pixie dream girl archetype is misogynist and harmful to women in the end? Because I feel like that is ultimately like what the loner girl fantasy is all about.
I think this is a super good question. In retrospect, all of these discourses are really interesting. I was boots on the ground, was there when the Your Fave is Problematic John Green post dropped on Tumblr. Boots on the ground, I was there. I remember where I was sitting. It was where kind of like, you? I feel
under
like
under a tree or something.
Probably in my closet, because I had a very loner girl closet. Like, have I shown you guys? Like, I have to post photos of this because it's crazy. Like, I had a very loner girl closet. Like, it was my Terabithia. Like, I cleaned out my closet and just posted all of these, like, a huge collage of, like, Teen Vogue cutouts. And then I had also, like, edited my face onto Jennifer Lawrence's body. And then I edited my face and printed it out and put it, like, on. And then edited my face onto Ryan Gosling's girlfriend.
You and it was so like this, nuanced.
It was like the weirdest fucking thing. But I think that's where I sat on Tumblr. Like, it's like honestly really odd behavior on my part, but I have to live my truth. But no, these are really odd discourses in retrospect, because we were really treating these things like with such heavy weight, you know, using the word slut as a man, you know, it was, we were at risk of removing the word slut from the English language. And now if you drive around LA, every other restaurant is called like egg slut or something, you know? And like, I don't know. I just don't think that even the archetype of man that would manic pixie dream girl a woman even exists anymore. That's my main issue with it, because I think it was a very specific type of guy who had his own rich inner world, but male aggression kind of turned it into this sort of disaffected, almost like proto incel-y, but not really incel-y vibe. Like, I think what comes to mind is a TikTok trend I've been seeing of like pick me guy, where it's like this, a guy is like sitting in a car and he's like, would you rather jump off the building or give a guy like me a hug or whatever, or something like that, or just like, you know what I mean? Where it is just very like that type of guy doesn't exist anymore. They're too liable to be roasted.
Yeah,
by
it's the
their
combination
peers.
Of the manic pixie dream girl discourse and the like quote unquote nice guy discourse of like, I don't know, like friend zoning and everything like that was such a big deal at the time. I guess the main fantasy of like John Green books is that they were always, it was always like a friends to lovers type of thing. Like it was always like a whirlwind friendship and like unrequited love situationship that happened. But yeah, we need to encourage friendship between young men and women. It's also, the slut erasure thing is so real though, because you remember when Misery Business was like a huge song, Paramore now has like edited it and doesn't say slut in the live version. And I feel like people now are still also looking back on like Taylor Swift's like You Belong With Me thing. Like I feel like she was kind of like a mainstream loner girl, like the whole she wears short skirts, I wear t-shirts of it all, which I feel like she's kind of returning to in her, like something about the tortured poets department, even as like an album name is so loner girl.
Yeah. But I feel like the loner girl was never socially integrated enough. She never had the social intelligence to actually be a pick me in the traditional modern definition.
Yeah.
Like I think she very much was just like a lot of the issues that made her different were a consequence of her not having social intelligence, you know? Which I think is good. I feel like we need more people like this. Like we cannot, this over-socialized like society is concerning to me. I think the pick-me
stuff has gone so far that now I'm starting to see things that are like, you know, if a girl even has like slightly unconventional interests, like she's getting accused of being a pick-me when it's like, you know, what happened to girls like actually just being a bit weird? Like if you're not like the archetype of like girl's girl, then you can get accused of being a pick-me, but it's like, that is just like imposing the male gaze or like implying that everything that women do is for male attention. I don't know.
It feels very like, not to be, you know, I don't want to start any wars or anything, but it feels like a very dictatorial impulse to be like, that's not girls' fault. Like, you know what I mean? Like girls that are like, it's, it just feels like dictatorial in a weird way.
Well, it's like the same thing as like the choice feminism thing, which is like, you have to support other women no matter what they're doing. It's like,
I didn't even make that connection. That's like so
But they
true.
Made it even stupider by calling it girls, girls. But I want to say that I think with John Green, like the way he writes these charismatic, eccentric young female characters, I think is actually just how teenage boys see girls like that.
Yeah.
Like they are truly larger than life in their heads. And that's just how it is. Like they're...
Is it controversial to say, like, I don't know, we're living in such a difficult time right now. Is it controversial to like kind of say, like, you guys tell me, is it controversial to say, like, I feel like the Manic Pixie Dream Girl was more of like a boy version of like, I can fix him. And almost like the consequences of thinking that way were like encoded within that mentality already. And like, you just kind of have to let guys learn. You know, where it comes with its own downfalls and we do not have to like attack guys for having this mentality, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't think it should be stigmatized to let girls be whimsical when they're young. You know, I feel like it's important for them to do cringy things that maybe are seen as like pick me or not like other girls or whatever you want to call it. But I think it's like important for people to work through those cringy moments in order to actually determine like what their personalities are.
That's very true. And the manic element, I feel like it's getting a bit like washed out, because I would see why people would think it's like misogynist if like, you know, the guy like romanticizes this girl and somehow like tames her down and like turns her into like a normal person. But they all end super tragically with like the girl being really self-destructive or just like disappearing out of nowhere or like getting in a car accident. So it's kind of like showing that.
Yeah.
You know,
but then I was like, thinking about that as well.
It's not real, like, or... It's ill-fated from Jump. It definitely is like an I can fix her type of thing. And the male characters are always so like nothing burger that is like, that's like the quote from Looking for Alaska where he's like, if people were rain, I was drizzle and she was a hurricane. And then this bitch gets in like a car accident and then he's like, did you kill herself? But there's a really good
times, guys.
Quote from Paper Towns where John Green's like self-awareness jumps out, if I may recite.
Oh, please.
Indeed.
So this is about the character Margot, who was played by Cara Delevingne in the fucking movie. Okay, it says, Margot Roth-Spiegelman was a person too, and I had never quite thought of her that way, not really. It was a failure of all of my previous imaginings. All along, not only since she left, but for a decade before, I had been imagining her without listening. The fundamental mistake I'd always made, and that she had, in fairness, always led me to make, was this. Margot was not a miracle. She was not an adventure. She was not a fine and precious thing. She was a girl. She was just a girl's girl.
I so remember that, like, being proliferated around Truth to Power.
Yeah.
Dude, I'm such a Green Brothers defender, honestly. Like, I love them.
I feel bad because I'm such a performative, like, hater of them because
Me too.
I obviously read all their books, but then I was like, ew, like, The Fault in Our Stars is so cringe. But now I've looped back around, and I'm sorry to anyone who feel that way.
Also,
reading books is good for kids in general.
Yeah, right. Sorry, go ahead, Biz. What have you discovered? Unearthed. Like, I feel like it's important.
Certainly this is gendered, but in The Fault in Our Stars, Augustus is a manic pixie dream boy.
Yeah, he is a panic.
And
like,
Hazel is a nothing burger, whatever you call it. She talks about how he's this like incredible, charming person who's so open to the world.
I think he's like the most manic pixie shit of all time.
I watched that movie recently. Again, you should all
watch
it.
You did? Oh my God.
Yeah, it was really good. I recommend it. It was even better 10 years on, to be honest. Okay, I wanted to say something quickly about how all of the loner girls, the manic pixie dream girls, they either kind of like self-immolate from their self-destructive habits or they die in these fictionalized stories. I was thinking about that and I'm like, is this a way for these male writers to be like, if I can't have her, no one can, and then she like has to die because she's like this impossible character, this impossible creature.
I mean, that's like the virgin suicides thing too, is that it's like from the perspective of the male gaze, like, and all of these like girls have left all of this destruction and confusion in their wake, and guys, I feel like I keep seeing discourse about how like guys never get over their first love. Like,
I've been seeing that too. So which does not feel true universally, not from the way that other men have. I've asked men this before, not recently,
we need to
investigate
the male one.
Well, what if your first love was like a loner girl or a manic pixie dream girl
and she died like in Bridge Terabithia, like in a horrible way?
Oh my God, I would never get over that.
No, you don't get over that type of thing.
Like, why can't they just grow up? Why can't they, like,
because they have to die, they have to be distilled into this memory of the author.
My reading of it, which I actually do think, let's be like Derridian or whatever, like all of these readings are so true, but like that's not actually Derridian. So people will be mad at me if I call it that. But like, I think you're right, Biz, but I think also it's like so like cringe, kind of like the dream can never exist because they're, you know, the manic pixie aspect of the girl, it like, can never be real. Like she is just a girl and flawed, you know? It's like the kind of thing where it's like, when you finally realize you'll never fix him, like he has to fix himself, like you have to just kill the image of them in your head something.
All I can think is that like we've made great advancements in mental health awareness because like now these girls would just like have a guidance counselor or like a therapist or something. Like the messaging is just so like recovery is not possible. Like if you have any troubled like psychological darkness to you, like you must die at 18. Like it was actually giving death sentence to be like a troubled teenager at this time.
Yeah,
that was so true. And I also feel like I remember when these books were being proliferated by my teachers and we were learning about, you know, the way that trauma manifests and stuff. and what was really interesting is like I, you know, being in school and you know these people, you know people who go through really horrible things when they're growing up, like your friends, it could be you, you know, but it's like the way that like trauma manifests oftentimes is like sexual promiscuity, kind of like risky behavior, shit that like is not described in these books, you know what I mean? So it just like is a really inaccurate portrayal of like how people actually respond to trauma, you know what I mean? I don't know. It just felt like almost like a way to like hide the signs of actual like troubled teens even more than to the general public. Like it just felt very...
Like what I was talking about before is that it was like assumed that if you were troubled you had to like express it. There was no like popular kid who is secretly getting abused at home type of thing. It's like if you were getting abused, like you had to be emo.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was very weird. But I mean also sometimes I look back on the past. Never mind.
Oh my God.
13 Reasons Why. Wait, we have to say that today is the 7-year anniversary of the TV show, but the failure of 13 Reasons Why and the like CW-ification of that damn TV show, like it obviously could have been done like in such a cool way, but they really chopped and screwed that story. and the mental health like discourse at the time was just not compatible with this thing. Like, I just remember when it came out, everyone was like, this show is glorifying suicide. And I was like,
oh yeah,
okay, why didn't we, like, that's not, it's just like showing that it happened.
Yeah.
Graphically.
Yeah. It's both Easter and the 7-year anniversary. So I feel like we have a lot to reflect on in terms of.
Yeah, Hannah Baker is risen again.
Yeah, she is risen.
I feel like Dylan Minnette, who plays Clay, I think, yeah, in 13 Reasons Why, is a manic pixie dream boy for many.
Yeah.
Women love him.
Yeah, he's an indie musician.
He is, yeah.
But he also, I feel like this time was like a very short-lived moment where guys that looked like the Baldkin from Toy Story were like everybody's celebrity crush. Like, I feel like Dylan O'Brien has this vibe. Dylan Minnette. Yeah. That one guy from We're the Millers. Will Poulter. I don't know.
Yeah, whatever. Something about having that buzz cut was really just inspiring.
Yeah, and then COVID hit and like everything changed. And
they couldn't get haircuts anymore. Archetype
of male fantasy. Yeah, they couldn't get
haircuts. Yeah, now they have floppy hair.
Yeah.
Yeah, 13 Reasons Why was really fascinating. I think everyone should look at the book cover. As Sam mentioned, this is like an incredible example of this loner girl style. And the other kind of twee thing about it is that she left like cassette tapes, and each one was like a reason why or something. And something about like the Sharpie and cassette tape of it all, and the like DIY project that she made of her suicide mystery seems very apt to this theme.
Yeah, the analog quality of it. Mm-hmm. I feel like also the fact that she managed to literally make her rich inner world extend past her own life is crazy. Mm-hmm. And is certainly going to be in the Hall of Fame for Loner Girl Rich Inner World contest.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess the Manic Pixie Dream Girl of it all, like, I will say that I did get the message from all of these books that like the number one way to get a guy to think about you all the time is to like disappear into thin air. So I think maybe it created a generation of like extremely avoidant attachment style women.
So true.
Because you're reading that all this shit from like the really point true, of view yeah. of men, and it's like, I can't stop thinking about her because she like is gone.
But now it's been like kind of Shira Sevenified, or kind of like a dark female energy tutorialified, where it's kind of, instead of it being a 13 Reasons Why vibe, it's more of a Robert Greene book type of vibe.
Mm-hmm. It was exhilarating to be a manic pixie dream girl at the time, to be honest.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if girls still know what that feels like.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like there's also a pre-online aspect to it where it's impossible to be a manic pixie dream girl with a social media presence.
That's true. Yeah, this aesthetic, I feel like, really began in the year 2000 and started, I think, it died with the TV show 13 Reasons Why, even though it felt like it died before, but 13 Reasons Why was almost like a zombified version of it, where that vibe was definitely disappearing intensely, and the nail in the coffin was that TV show. Because even the way that she dresses in the show, you know, the denim jackets, the skinny scarves, the long wavy hair, and kind of the bangs pinned back in a romantic Renaissance fairy tale way. She does wear tights.
But
she
gets a fuck ass bob though.
Yeah, she got. But that was like one of her reasons, right? I don't remember.
The hairdresser is the reason.
Wasn't that like a thing?
I honestly don't think the bob was a part of the book.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
I dated this guy who was like obsessed with Hannah Baker. Like, it was really weird.
Girl, what? That's like really crazy.
It was like his celebrity crush. Like, he literally had a picture of her as the background of his phone.
Was it like a joke or
no? It like was not a joke. He was like a Chinese international student type. It was so weird.
Oh wow. Okay. Well, that
kind of I can see it. She's pretty.
Should we talk about Purple? I just have a theory that Purple is important because everyone as a child as a female child is forced to choose between being a pink girl or a purple girl. And once you choose purple, or it chooses you, you are immediately on the path of the other.
Mm-hmm.
And you will never escape it. You'll never be normal. And Yeah, we need to bring back that like eggplant purple. Like, I think everyone is kind of on the same page of it being fugly right now, but we need to like listen to the Miuccia Prada inside and be like, get the purple tights and the avocado shirt on.
Yeah.
And do not fear.
I mean, I just got a pair of glasses because I realized I have poor vision and should not have been driving, but I got a pair of prescription glasses that are purple, and I feel like that kind of set the ball rolling for this episode because I bought them as backup glasses, and I think that like at face value they would be office chic, but I didn't really want them to be office chic because I feel like that's not really my vibe or would not be a good vibe on me. So I was like, how do I style these? And then realized that I should just style them like a girl who eats lunch in the library and crochets her own hats and wanders and conquers the crochet in the woods.
I was thinking about the crochet of it all, and Biz, you were right when you were talking about like the baby and the grandma.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's also brilliant. The cancer patient.
Yeah. Oh, fuck.
Not the cancer patient, not the Hazel Grace.
But you were.
But they were always wearing crocheted hats. Like, for example, when my mom had cancer and when I was in high school, she got so much free crocheted stuff because like every knitting circle or like there's just a lot of people who like knit for cancer patients. And now I have like mm-hmm. all of this really quirky like crocheted beanie collection as a result. But
I'd love to see that.
Yeah, that sounds really, yeah. really fun.
It that's does definitely just a relic scream, of the like, time vulnerable too. Population though.
Yeah.
That's why it also reminds me of like Gypsy Rose a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's the kind of proto trauma core of it all, you know? Before trauma core was a thing. Yeah. Tough to kind of talk through that one, but yeah. The purple feels important. I stopped wearing purple after I watched a little bit of Breaking Bad, and like they made like the craziest character on the show, or like the most kind of neurotic character, which is Hank's wife. I forget her name. She's like one of those people that's like obsessed with purple. And it clicked for me that like, oh, there are those people that are like obsessed with purple. She's like a kleptomaniac and like is addicted to like lying about.
Oh yeah, I forgot about her. Thing.
Yeah. So I was just kind of like that is kind of the vibe of the color purple. And I stopped wearing it until I got these glasses and started shopping for kind of like archival Marc Jacobs, which I now own almost entirely. My closet is now made up of Marc Jacobs for some reason. And yeah, I feel like this is definitely the vibe for spring and summer for me, even though it's quite a cozy fall vibe, I think.
Yeah, it's so fall. I wish that I had tapped in earlier. But I feel like there is a side of it that you can do with like summer colors.
Yeah, yeah. There's like the baby, like a baby doll shirt with khaki shorts or something, and
yeah, and those sneaker flats, I mean, amazing to wear
sneaker flats. Yeah,
they do for every season.
They're a seasonal staple for sure.
I definitely have a lot of I like footwear and have a lot of stinky shoes I need to replace with other stinky shoes.
Yeah, this girl would not be caught dead in anything with even a slight heel for sure.
Yeah, it's so true.
But it's because she's like, giving like I walk home from school.
Yeah,
on like a two-lane road.
Yeah,
like, in the woods. We shouldn't be walking.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, anything else, guys?
I don't think so.
Okay. Well,
I have a would you rather.
Oh.
Okay, go for it. You can go.
Okay. Would you rather go back in time and be friends with with Husky Marc Jacobs and Sofia Coppola, or would you rather go back in time and be John Green's muse, who he has one-itis for, and all of his female characters are based on you?
Well, John Green has one-itis for his wife, Sarah, the art historian.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I know.
Legacy is so intense.
Yeah, it's so weird. Like, he went to a boys' college and all this sort of thing. So it's can't even. That's okay. Well,
that's where that's all why the he has one-itis for.
Oh well, maybe. Yeah, I definitely would rather be friends with Husky Mark. I think that'd be really a unique opportunity.
Yeah, me too. I would have discouraged him from getting shredded, but I would have encouraged him to get those tattoos that he has, which I think are the coolest tattoos. He has like a SpongeBob tattoo and like red M&M tattoo and like a tattoo of himself with tattoos. Like,
that's amazing.
He's got the craziest fucking tats. And
yeah, I would have told his wanted hand to at the get tattoo him. Appointment.
Yeah, we would have gotten matching SpongeBobs.
What about you, Alexi?
I don't know. I would definitely like to have a legacy in YA literature. So I would say maybe I would be kicking it with John Green. I would go visit him at Boys College.
Kenyon College.
Kenyon College? Wait, is that what you said?
That's what it's called.
Wait, oh, what?
Yeah. Yeah. It's in Ohio.
Ohio, wow.
Kenyon used to be such a vibe, damn.
Yeah.
I feel like even when I was in high school, there were kids who were like really dreaming about going to Kenyon.
Yeah, probably because of, honestly, John Green like put it on the map for our generation. But it's kind of like, you know, Oberlin-esque, like, let's go out to the country.
Yeah, but it's so specifically creative writing focused, I think.
Yeah. I don't know, to be honest, about their curriculum. But, okay, my Would You Rather is actually not that good, but it felt good in the moment.
I'm sure it's good.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm excited.
What would you guys rather do your loner girl baby nursery in? Misha Sludge or grunge fairy core green?
Baby nursery?
Yeah, wait, why do I have a baby?
Yeah, like you're having a baby.
Like in a teen pregnancy.
And wait, you have a feeling like, that yeah, she's going to be the loner girl?
It's no, you're yes. like the secret life of the American teenager, teen pregnant. And
I think,
sorry, I'm like, sorry, this is your Would You Rather business.
Yeah, Sam, shut your trap. Okay. Would you, no, I feel like, okay, I can't tell if you're the loner girl or she's going to be your popular daughter and you're weird. It's up to you.
Mm. I think I would have to do Mucha Sludge, though. That's an amazing theme for a nursery.
Okay. It would hide all the poop stains.
Yeah, that's so true. You just walk in there and there's like, yeah, never mind. I'm having a really hard time picturing it, but I think maybe like raising a baby in an environment that's like kind of busted like that. I don't know. It's also like cozy. Like every time I think of rooms that are painted that color, like babies need high contrast. So it could be good.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the Mucha Sludge would be, because I feel like, unfortunately, grunge fairycore is oftentimes found on Shein and Temu or Amazon Marketplace, which it shouldn't be, but it was kind of easily replicated into this sort of kind of fast fashion, factory made, you know, stuff. So I just feel like I don't know what kind of like BPAs or like toxic chemicals are encoded within like the objects I'm going to put in the nursery.
Fairy core brands, so.
Yeah, exactly. So it just feels like more baby safe to do Mucha Sludge. And I think I could find a lot of that stuff like kind of in antique stores and make it a little, you know, I feel like it'd be a cool a reading cunt. Room. I could kind of see the rocking chair, my nursing chair.
I mean, in the Vogue runway review of that show, they say that she was inspired by 70s dishware, which is like, maybe you could put like cotton pads or something in some 70s dishware and make it like a whole 70s thing.
But now it's getting more toxic because you know that 70s dishware has like lead in it.
Yeah, that's true. You know? It like glows radioactive.
But I just feel like all of this is like a stone's throw away from Mushroom and Froggy Land. And I feel like we're probably seeing a lot of mushroom nurseries pop up right now. So
that's like the most envy.
I'm not saying that it needs to be like that, but if you wanted to give the baby a plush toy that matched, you could give it a mushroom.
That's true.
That would be cute.
Yeah, I'm still gonna go with the Mucha Sludge because I'm seeing. Yeah, I'm just like kind of imagining getting moss from like the Dollar Tree and it's just turning like I'm already like picturing this nursery and it's becoming more and more lush and the disposable items that I would get from because I've actually feel like I've like tried to buy grunge fairy core things before and they've kind of fallen apart after one wash type thing and you have to wash stuff a lot when you have a baby so I'm gonna have to go with the Muccia.
Yeah, that's true. Also, the Prada nylon is like famously easy to clean.
Really?
Ooh. The wet cloth, you can just, yeah.
Having a Prada baby would be fun. God, yeah, I can't think of any would you rathers. I guess like
would you rather books, and I'm like, would you rather not speak for a year or kill yourself and like a bunch of audio tapes for people to listen to?
Definitely not speak for a year, I think. But yeah, I was gonna do something with like leg warmers. Like, would you rather like wear leg warmers every single day and you can't take them off and you have to like shower with them and like everything? Or would you rather wear a crochet beanie every day and same thing, like you can't take it off, you shower with it?
Honestly, leg warmers.
Yeah.
Like, even though, yeah, I don't know, just like a hat is such a commitment. Leg warmers, you could pull them up, you could push them down. I feel like I'm always wearing socks or like stockings anyway, so it's not a far cry from my real life.
I feel like it would really complicate the way that I like live my life though, because I wear a lot of like shorts and pants, and I just feel like leg warmer under pants is a risky move. It's like risky business. I'm gonna go with the beanie. I think I am gonna go with the beanie for some reason.
Oh, I do feel like you would look really good in this style of beanie, Sam.
Yeah, your hair would be like exploding out from under it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But I would have It'd to reveal cute. My actually quite small head, which people don't know that I have.
The truth comes out.
And I don't like, I'm insecure about it.
No, don't be insecure. I think I would probably do leg warmers because I think it's easier to be like, no, this is a different pair than I wore yesterday than if it's a hat, you know?
That's like a true. Hat.
It'd be hard to pass that off.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well.
All right, well.
Time to go be lonely.
That was great.
I'm gonna be lonely now, yeah.
Having a podcast is like the opposite of like a loner girl.
You're just like chatty ass girls.
It's like the complete lack of mystique and
truly.
Also, like being a loner girl is like being not able to communicate, but I'm glad we were able to communicate on their behalf today.
Yeah. It was difficult to talk about too, because it is such a nonverbal aesthetic. Mm-hmm. But we tackled it with grace, I think.
Yeah. Come forward if you are a former lonely girl.
You're like our muse. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean,
this is a Nymphed alumni approved aesthetics. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Mark's muse. And Betsy Johnson's muse.
And John Green's muse.
Anna Sui's muse.
John Green's muse.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, guys.
Goodbye, everyone.
Bye. We're going to Terabithia.
Yeah. I feel like I had to make her, actually.